1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about Cable Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland unless otherwise noted. The next engineering committee will meet Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO, Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Joel Greenberg, attorney with Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon upholds the civil rights of people with disabilities. It is the protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities in Oregon. Joel Greenberg is author of a new report, The Independent Investigation of the Death of Michael Barton, Mental Illness and Medical Neglect in an Oregon Prison. Hi, Joel. Welcome.
Good evening.
Joel, congratulations on your new report. Let's start with, who was Michael Barton and how did he end up in the Oregon prison system?
In one sense, I guess I would say that who Michael Barton was and how he ended up in prison are irrelevant, because what happened to him shouldn't happen to anyone. But it may interest your listeners to know something about him. Michael Barton was an individual who experienced serious mental illness throughout much of his adult life. And recently, he was living perhaps on the streets or perhaps with friends in the Medford vicinity, and he was reliant on psychotropic medications to control his symptoms of mental illness. For some reason, perhaps the medication became ineffective, or he wasn't taking them or ran out of them, but he became totally preoccupied with the idea that he would not be able to continue his medications unless he had some additional money. And in his mind at that point, which was probably already troubled, he decided that the most common sense and logical way to deal with the lack of medications would be to rob a bank. He made this decision apparently on the spur of the moment. On his way out from a friend's house, he picked up a kitchen knife, carried it with him into the bank, but forgot to display the knife when he went up to the counter and asked the teller for the money. The videotapes, which I have not seen but were described to me by his public defender, indicated that he was calm, unconcerned, and apparently thought of this as an everyday event. In any case, he left the bank with a red bag full of money, his bottle of Gatorade, and walked out of the bank as if nothing had happened, and was apparently very surprised when police encountered him about a block away and pulled out guns and so forth. And he said, "I'm the one. I did it." He was subsequently convicted of crimes related to the bank robbery, and his problems with his serious mental illness continued when he eventually ended up in the prison.
So this bank robbery occurred in April 2017, and he was convicted and sent to prison. And then what happened?
When he entered prison, although the notes in the records that we observed or reviewed are not clear, it was clear that he encountered some kind of problems in being able to just navigate the daily rigors of prison life. And a decision was made to move him to the ICH, which stands for the Intermediate Care Housing Unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary.
What were some of his behaviors at that time that led him to be transferred to the Intermediate Care Housing Unit at OSP?
I'm not aware of what behaviors led to the transfer. However, I am aware of what his behavior was like once he was at the ICH. And his behavior suggested strongly that he was suffering from a fairly advanced stage of dementia in addition to his serious mental illness. And some of the indicators of the dementia were that there are numerous notes in his treatment records at the ICH describing how Mr. Barton was continually frustrated and stymied by the task of opening his cell door when it was unlocked. He was unable to remember when it was unlocked, and he was unable to operate the simple door mechanism even when workers told him, "You can leave now. Michael, it's time to go out." He was not able to use the door. A simple task, which would be turning on and off a faucet, stymied him on at least one occasion, during which a mental health worker noticed, found him banging his head on the wall because after turning on the water, he was unable to figure out how to turn the water off by simply operating the faucet mechanism in his cell.
So he was transferred in September 2017 to the Oregon State Penitentiary for a higher level of treatment for his mental health state.
Again, the records are not altogether clear about what the reason was, but the ICH is a unit that is primarily purposed with serving prisoners who find it difficult to manage normal prison life in other institutions. Most, if not all of them, have some sort of mental illness. Some are developmentally disabled. Others, like Mr. Barton, probably have dementia, diagnosed or not. But in any case, the unit is purposed with helping people who simply can't deal with the normal tasks and demands of living in a prison.
So, Joel Greenberg, let's fast forward to January 2018. Mr. Barton was experiencing symptoms consistent with the flu.
That's what the records say, and that's what witnesses who contacted DRO told us. It appeared that he had simply caught the flu.
And then what happened?
Well, he became increasingly ill, gradually becoming weaker, and at some point, and I don't know whether this happened actually before he had the flu or not, but it appears that it happened afterward, he was unable to walk, had to use a wheelchair to move anywhere. He became, as I said, weak. His limbs gradually became discolored and swollen, and his weakness got to the point where he couldn't get out of his bunk, couldn't get out of the bed in his cell, and it progressed to a point where even that was not the limit of what he could not do. He couldn't lift his head to drink water, even if it was offered to him. So someone would have to lift his head, hold the glass of water in front of him, and help him drink it. So clearly he became quite ill, whether it was flu or not. He was a person who people with medical expertise would have said, something is wrong here, and people without medical expertise did contact both nursing and physicians to say, this man is very sick, something's wrong, he needs help.
And who were those people that were seeing the symptoms and complaining and seeking help for Michael Barton?
Well, the individuals who contacted us and described all of the things that I've been telling you about included both inmates and employees or staff members of the Department of Corrections.
So January 2018, he is suffering from the flu. Apparently, his condition is worsening. What happened next to Mr. Barton?
Well, he was taken to the infirmary a number of times where he begged to stay for a number of reasons. One, he just felt terribly ill and thought he was going to die. And the other reason that he voiced a number of times was that he believed he was dizzy or being poisoned by the water in his cell. And although the nursing staff and the medical providers told him that he was probably trying to stand and not able to do it, and that's what was making him dizzy, he was convinced that the water in his cell was poisoning him. He begged and cried on at least two occasions to be kept in the infirmary. On both occasions, he was returned to his cell.
And then what happened?
Again, this is all happening over about a two-week period. Numerous people are very alarmed at how he looks, sounds, his weakness, his inability to stand up, and so forth. And it gets to the point on two occasions, I think, where nursing staff came to his cell to provide medications, to help him drink water and so forth, and just ended up arguing with him at the door of his cellway, refusing to enter, not taking his vital signs, not examining him, and just telling him, you need to drink water, you need to rest, everything will be fine.
So the nurses were not actually going into his cell to check his vitals. All this was occurring from outside of Mr. Barton's cell?
That's what the witnesses and the records tell us. That's correct.
So why weren't the nurses or medical staff taking care of Mr. Barton? His condition was obviously worsening. People were complaining, asking, pleading for help for Mr. Barton.
Well, of course, I can't know the actual reason because I can't look into the brains of the people who failed to treat him adequately. But what the witnesses described and what was also described to some extent in records and reviews of what happened to Mr. Barton was that the nurses in particular saw Mr. Barton as a difficult person.
But if they read Mr. Barton's medical records, they would have seen that he had a long history of mental illness and there were obvious signs of dementia.
Well, it raises a disturbing possibility, which is that they were aware of his dementia and mental illness, but considered those to be problems that it wasn't their job to deal with. So we end up with a situation where a person who's so compromised by, in this case, mental illness and dementia, that he's not a good patient, he's not good at describing symptoms, he's not good at listening or taking medical advice, and therefore, in my mind, would need an extra level of expertise and care and thought about how to deal with him, instead got exactly the opposite. They viewed him as, a pain in the neck, someone who was causing problems, someone who was interfering with the schedule of medications, someone who was having them called to his cell numerous times, someone who was going back and forth from the infirmary, someone who needed a wheelchair. All of these things were apparently viewed by some of the nursing and medical staff as problems for them rather than indications of problems that Mr. Barton was suffering.
Mr. Barton then had a scheduled appointment to visit the infirmary in February. What occurred at that time?
Well, I would back up shortly before that and say that his condition became so grave that a number of people tried very hard to get either security and or medical to come to his cell. Eventually, a nurse came to his cell and without entering and without taking his vitals, looked at him while other witnesses were watching and said his condition, whatever it was, could wait until morning because he had a scheduled appointment at the infirmary. Following that, the nurse left, and some of the people who spoke to me continued through that night to try to convince someone that his condition was too serious to wait until the scheduled appointment the next morning. Their pleas, however, were not effective. He was not taken to the infirmary that night, and on the next morning, an inmate helper with a wheelchair came to get Mr. Barton to take him to his scheduled appointment. When he arrived, he found Mr. Barton moaning faintly. His skin color was what was described as a ghastly or pale shade of gray. His limbs were discolored and swollen, and he was lifted as if dead weight into the wheelchair because he had no ability to help the person who had come to get him get into the chair. And as the inmate helper started wheeling Mr. Barton out of the unit, out of the ICH, toward the infirmary, they only made it a few feet before Mr. Barton's head slumped to one side. His bladder was emptied down his leg. He lost consciousness and essentially began dying at that point. He was dead one day later.
And Jill, what was the cause of death?
Well, ultimately, when all life support was stopped at the hospital where he was taken after he lost consciousness, a number of procedures were completed, one of which was to relieve the pressure on his lungs from what turned out to be a pneumothorax. And that's a condition where fluid presses down on the lungs so hard that they become incapable of operating. And during that procedure, approximately 4 liters of what was described as a prurient fluid, which was MRSA-infected fluid, was removed from his lungs. So we're talking about close to a gallon of fluid had invaded or built up inside of Mr. Barton's chest. It had made it very difficult for him to breathe. It was also, because it was MRSA-infected, it indicated that he, in one sense, died of a treatable infection, MRSA. The cause of death was listed as organ failure. I can't remember the formal language, but it was organ failure following illness and an infection of MRSA. MRSA is treatable. However, it's not easily treatable if it's not diagnosed. And one of the problems and sad things in this case was that Mr. Barton's infection was never diagnosed until he was, to use the common phrase, on death's door.
Joel, you mentioned several times about witnesses who came forward, contacted Disability Rights Oregon about the treatment and death of Michael Barton. Would DRO or the public have known about the circumstances surrounding Michael Barton's death had it not been for these witnesses?
No. It's interesting that even his family did not know anything about the circumstances of his death. They were aware of his death only because of a Facebook posting by some friend that they read, which I believe they described as Michael Barton, RIP. And they contacted that person and were told that Mr. Barton had died of natural causes in prison.
So talk about these witnesses, these courageous people that came forward. Your report says that almost a year later, they were still haunted by the circumstances that led to Michael Barton's death.
That's right. The investigation began, and we asked for, collected, and reviewed records because a person had been so disturbed by, again, I'm using the pronoun she, without actually saying that this was a female person. This person was so disturbed by what she had seen and witnessed over the last 2 or 3 weeks of Mr. Barton's life that she felt she could not remain silent, and she ended up contacting DRO and speaking to me about what she had seen and witnessed. And she did so very reluctantly, but she felt she had no other choice. She was unable to live with herself.
And why the reluctance?
The reluctance, whether grounded in reality or not, was based on her fear of retaliation. And
by whom?
Well, that's an interesting question. There were two kinds of retaliation raised by both her and the other folks who contacted DRO. And one sort of retaliation is what I would call informal, and that would be retaliation by colleagues or fellow prisoners, fellow workers, and employees of DOC who might resent or be angry that what's supposed to stay in the prison and be secret was revealed to the public. So that was described by everyone who talked to me. And some or all of them also felt that it was reasonable to fear more official or administrative kinds of retaliation. Perhaps they would be moved to a different cell or be demoted or not get a promotion. I'm not in any position to know whether either one of those fears is based in reality, but I can tell you that the people who spoke to me or contacted me about what happened to Mr. Barton all wanted to remain anonymous and all were very reluctant to speak to me, but felt that they really had no other choice.
The Oregon Department of Corrections physician did his own review of Michael Barton's death. What did they conclude?
They reached a number of conclusions, many of which were disturbing and cause for future recommendations about how things should be changed. But the overall conclusion reached by ODOC was that Mr. Barton's death was attributable to what they called a system failure. And by that, they meant that at a number of critical points in the last few weeks of his life, poor decisions were made or adequate care was not delivered. They questioned the decision not to admit him to the infirmary. They questioned the failure of the nurses to enter his cell and take vital signs and so forth. and they saw this as a confluence of a number of factors that they described as a system failure. I would like to say that although I concluded after my own review, which was in some sense informed by sources of information that were not available to the Oregon Department of Corrections, that although there was a system failure, there was also a failure on the part of individual nurses and or physicians. So it's true the system didn't work, but one of the reasons the system didn't work is that many of the actors in it did not do their jobs well.
And what are some of Disability Rights Oregon's recommendations?
As for recommendations or what we believe would ensure that what happened to Mr. Barton does not happen to anyone else, first and foremost, we think it would be important for the Oregon Department of Corrections to hire an independent prison health expert. And that person should be hired and given access to all sources of information and employees to look into how the system of care works, and with a particular focus on how it works for individuals such as Mr. Barton who have disabilities. The point of that expert reviewing records, talking to people, visiting the various facilities in the ICH and elsewhere in the system would be to identify the root causes of what I would call the tragedy of Michael Barton's death, and to recommend how to implement necessary changes to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. There are more detailed recommendations about how that would happen, but our only other significant recommendation, I would say, is that at the conclusion of this expert's work, he or she should provide a set of recommendations, again, that identify the root causes, recommended changes to be made in the system, and published a report that would be available to the public so that there was some sunlight shined on a system that failed at least one person and will fail others if it's not changed.
And Joel, where could people find your report?
They can call DRO at 503-243-2081, and we will send them a copy, or they can visit our website and download it for free. DROOregon.org.
Joel, your report on the death of Michael Barton suggests or indicates that there is a cultural change that is needed in the Oregon prison system.
I can say that I think the Department of Corrections has labored hard and somewhat effectively in a number of ways to change the conditions for people with disabilities, in particular people with serious mental illness. They've made some significant changes in the behavioral health unit. They've increased their training. They've done a lot of good things for our clients. That said, I think your point about a cultural change is a good one, because in my view, after looking at what happened to Mr. Barton, I would say one of the key problems is that the culture, at least amongst the nursing staff and the medical personnel at the Oregon State Penitentiary, was not up to the task of dealing effectively and providing good medical treatment and diagnosis for a person with a serious disability that rendered him unable to be a good advocate for his own health needs. So we're talking again about a person who can't operate a water faucet or a cell door. And the idea that that person is going to be able to do what you or I might if we had a medical problem, which would be to get an appointment with the right physician, choose a different one if we didn't like that physician, explain symptoms, listen to medical advice, go get a second opinion. None of those things were within reach for Mr. Barton, even if they were available in the prison system. And as we know, they're probably not, at least to some extent. But for a person who was as impaired as Mr. Barton was, the idea that he would be able to do those things is kind of ridiculous. So the culture needs to change in the sense that the people who are protecting Mr. Barton's life are his only source of medical health care need to understand that his limitations mean, as I discussed a bit earlier, that he needs extra time extra attention and an extra sort of sensibility about the difference between what the person is saying and what they're able to describe and what you can find out by other means, such as talking to other witnesses, doing extra diagnostic tests, being willing and able and funded to refer out to a more acute care kind of facility or one with better diagnostic facilities. All of those things need to be available, and the gatekeepers are the nurses and medical staff, in this case at the Oregon State Penitentiary. And in this case, the gates were closed, and the result was the death of a man who probably would still be alive if things had happened in a different way. Our report does conclude that there is a cultural problem, that there needs to be a cultural change. I don't believe that the Oregon Department of Corrections would agree with that. I could be wrong. I do give them credit for understanding that there was a system failure here. Their own review did not whitewash what happened in the sense that it could have, but did not say, you know, all of this was unavoidable. This was simply something that would have happened anywhere. I think their review, to the extent that it was not hampered by a lack of some additional sources of information, was thorough and was well-intended, and it did uncover some serious problems in what happened in this one case. It also said the problems were systemic, suggesting that they will and need to look at changes. Where we may or may not differ with the Oregon Department of Corrections is how serious that need is, what the pace of those changes needs to be, and how best to make sure that those changes do happen.
And Jill, do you have any thoughts about the witnesses who came forward?
In spite of the difficulty of being, you know, essentially what's called a snitch in prisons and jails across the country, we're talking about employees who are subject to all kinds of negative possibilities if they reveal secrets. We're talking about prisoners who have very little control over their conditions of confinement, where they're housed, how security people treat them, whether they're going to get medical care the next time they need it. All of those things are in the control of other people. In my view, each of the people who came forward and spoke to me or communicated with me about what happened to Mr. Barton are heroes.
So, Joel, thank you so much for this report, The Independent Investigation of the Death of Michael Barton, Mental Illness and Medical Neglect in an Oregon Prison. Again, you can find the report at droregon.org. Joel, any final words?
Well, I want to thank you for your interest in the report. I think it raises some important issues, but I would like to say that I did not certainly enjoy doing this investigation or writing this report, and it was not intended to embarrass or call the Oregon Department of Corrections to task in the way that we might have in some other situations. There are many factors, I think, that contributed to Mr. Barton's death and contribute to the culture that allowed it to happen, and it is my hope that DRO can continue to work with the Department of Corrections to make needed changes and reforms that will ensure that there are no more Mr. Bartons. So I am hopeful that that will happen, and I look forward to the opportunity to work with the Department of Corrections in the future.
Joel Greenberg, attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest, Karen.
That was Prison Pipeline. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Hard Knock Radio will return tomorrow night. Up next, Sojourner Truth.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success.
and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll show the documentary film The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Cave is a story of female doctors saving lives in a secret underground hospital in Syria. The film follows the women as they contend with daily bombardments, chronic supply shortages, and the ever-present threat of chemical attacks. It paints a stirring portrait of courage, resilience, and female solidarity. Again, that's The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. River of Darkness, Slavery and Empire in the Cotton Kingdom, the title of a book by Harvard University history professor Walter Johnson. We spend the hour with Professor Johnson. From the days of slavery to the start of the Civil War, he discusses the interrelationship between slavery and the building of empire on both sides of the Atlantic, the expansionist vision of the slaveholding class, the remaking of Mississippi from forested lands to cotton plantations, the centrality of slavery to capitalism and the global economy, jails for slaves, and the continuum with today's mass incarceration. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship